The TED Dreams by Faye Weldon and read by Tamsin Kennard for Saga Egmont. Chapter 1. It was the night before Christmas, and all through the house not a creature was stirring, not even a mouse. Except a clot of blood, creeping up from Ted's leg to his brain, there to burst and kill him as he slept. He'd been complaining earlier of a swelling and some mild pain in his calf. That was all. I'd spent the day in a mood of sulky despair, wishing that I was somebody else, or at least that I lived with somebody else. And even while I shopped for presents and prepared for the next day's festivities, I was planning my escape from what seemed a grievous marriage. Of course, as soon as Ted died, I forgot all that, and the only thing that was grievous was his death. I had loved him. I still loved him. The loss of him was intolerable. I married again as soon as I could. I can't even remember the exact source of that day's particular grievance, but anything would have done to fuel my resentments and keep poor Ted's faults, rather than his virtues, mulling away in my head, almost to the exclusion of all else. I was in a negative state of being, a captious, resentful mood. I do remember that I shopped ineptly that morning, and in the afternoon curdled the mayonnaise, and that Ted commented,
"Women are like the weather. Their moods blow in and out like the wind. Time of the month, perhaps?"
Which I denied, though of course it was true. Actually, I think our moods blow in with our dreams, and it's dreams which control the matrimonial weather. Ted and I were married when I was 18, a week after my adoptive parents died in a car crash. They had been out shopping for her mother of the bride outfit. She appeared to me the following night in a dream in which she wore the dress, pale green with flouncy bits. Something of a mistake, I thought, even at the time, though in life she was never to wear it. The outfit, dress, jacket, leafy hat, satin shoes, had been found still in its Debenhams bag in the boot of the semi-submerged car. She had leaned over me where I lay in bed with Ted and said, "Funeral or not, take no notice of her. The wedding must go ahead." So it had. I was with Ted for 20 years before death took him from me. There had been a lot of sex, and sex usually gave me vivid dreams. When the dreams were good, and he and I lived in a pleasant dreamscape, our days would be happy and productive. When the dreams were bad, our days would be clouded. When they were nightmares, when I was premenstrual, they would feature Ted as the bad guy, even as I lay beside him in the double bed, breath and limbs as one, he sleeping peacefully and innocently enough. In those dreams, I would find him in bed with Sinara, his partner from the art gallery, or trying to murder Martha and Maud, our twin daughters, or lunging at me with a knife while my legs would be rooted to the spot, or all my teeth falling out, that sort of thing. Then I would wake up angry with Ted and spend the whole day furious, and the emotional weather would be set, cold, bleak, and judgmental. Poor Ted. He must have had a hard time from me. I, too, had a hard time from my heaving hormonal states. Some of us are just more female than others. Life flowed through me in the messiest of ways. Yet, to an extent, one must be responsible for one's own dreams. They happen in one's own head. Though, actually, that's the kind of thing I would have said before Robbie appeared on the scene. Now I am not so sure. Robbie is my current husband. I married him 10 months to the day after Ted died, and I've been married to him for 10 months. My grief therapist had warned me not to embark on a relationship so soon after my loss, but I'd ignored her. A good man is hard to find, I told her. They don't just hang about on trees like ripe fruit waiting to be plucked. And to me, 10 months of celibacy seemed a very long time indeed. Robbie has been supportive.